PME delegation. I'd like to meet the staff and thank them for preparing and making these arrangements, making it possible for us to sit as a committee and do our work. I would also like to welcome all the guests, because our meetings are open meetings and we are guided by our rules and the Constitution on public participation to deepen democracy. So all guests are welcome. Indeed, this is one of the important meetings wherein we will be receiving a presentation from the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation on the review of identified programs and spending areas at risk in terms of budget execution. Now, this is information that we need, and it will empower us to strengthen our oversight. That is why I'm going to ask members to listen attentively, carefully, so that when the opportunity is given to members, indeed they engage on a robust discussion. The NDP and the MTSF provide the broad framework in which budget allocations are made. And you remember then that those budget allocations, the minister will just table those budget allocations. But the people who will recommend for the adoption of those allocations, it's us. So you'll see that DPME then becomes a strategic partner to assist us to do our work effectively and efficiently. Our main concern as SCOA is where are the key areas where we can intervene timeously with the time given to us. And we are well aware that we are left with, it's no longer 18 months, I think it's 17 months. We're doing a countdown. So within this 18 months, this is the time that the Lord has given us to work and make an impact in his children's lives. This one. So we mustn't take it for granted. Of course, as SCOA, our other main concern is deepening transformation or realization of transformation, because we've been talking about transformation from the time when, from 1994 to date. But now this time we want to see its realization and acceleration of implementation of the National Development Plan. And I hope you hear me on this one, acceleration of implementation of the National Development Plan. The committee wants to ensure that we accelerate the inclusive growth that we promised the people, government promised the people out there, create decent work, and promote investment in a competitive economy, but also bridge the gap. Instead of this gap between the haves and the have-nots, instead of it being narrowed down, but it looks like it is becoming bigger and bigger. So as we do our oversight, we've got to insist on this being, on this big gap being narrowed, so that at least even those who come from the previously disadvantaged, they also benefit in terms of the economy of South Africa. Those that come from the poor backgrounds, they also benefit from this economy. The presentation should give insights on which areas need to be prioritized for focused oversight and support in the remaining period of this MTSF. Mr. Basiles, I'm sure you hear that term. Just give us prioritize. You know, which areas we need to prioritize for focused oversight and support in the remaining period. This will be key as we head into the last phase of your into the MTBPS. Let us have a fruitful and robust engagement on this very important briefing. I want to thank you for coming, but also thanks thank members for coming to make this meeting successful. We will then move on to item number two, which is apologies. Are there any apologies?
Good morning, honourable members. We have an apology from Honourable Ndlangwini, who is a bereavement, and an apology from Honourable Ngwangwa, who's overseas. And I received an apology from Honourable McLachlan. I'm just not sure whether it was for yesterday or today. It
for
wasn't
the whole week.
Okay.
No. Oh, yesterday only. Okay. All right. Let's say it was yesterday's. Because I know he spoke to me about his wife was admitted for operation. So I think to me that's why it not be for one day. Because it means he's away. Oh, pre-operation. Okay, no, that's fine. No, that's okay. No, let's then take it that he has not submitted the apology for today. And Mr. Topham also has not submitted. Okay, no, that's fine. Can you please register those as absent? We will then move forward to the presentation by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. Over to you, Mr. Masilela and your team.
The Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members of the Committee, colleagues, good morning. Chairperson, we once more wish to express our humble gratitude to the committee for inviting us to do this presentation this morning. We also wish to thank the chairperson for the opening remarks because they contextualize this presentation exactly the same way we would have wished it to be contextualized. The invitation that we have received requested the DPME to present the identified programs and spending areas at risk in terms of budget execution. And this is what is going to be the heart of the presentation. Chairperson, I'm going to be doing it jointly with Mr. John Kruger and our colleague Dr. Tabamo Mabuhane, when he's done with his commitments for this morning, he'll also join us. As reflected in the next slide, the opening remarks by the chairperson have actually captured this slide in its entirety, because the NDP is implemented through the MTSF, and again, the purpose is to look at areas at risk. We have also included a few slides on what is coming up from the evaluation system that the DPME is running. The chairperson also indicated that we are no longer left with 18 months, but 17 months before the end of this administration. And therefore, we have reflected some of the high-impact interventions which our minister presented here on the 15th of August when he led the DPME team to this committee. But prior to that, he had presented those high-impact interventions to cabinet, and they had been endorsed. That is how we have structured it, Chairperson. On this slide, we just once more reflecting the three levers for implementing the NDP. And honorable members of the committee, I believe, will be familiar with these ones. The first one is a strong and inclusive economy. The second one is a capable state and active citizenry. And the third one is enhancing the capabilities of South Africans. There are 14 outcomes which the country is implementing and which the DPME is monitoring. These 14 outcomes, what we have done on this slide is to map them against the three levers for implementing the NDP. As honorable members will see that under the economy, we've got outcome 4, 5, 6, 7, and 10. In the middle oblong, or the middle oval shape, under capable state and active citizenry, we've got outcomes 3, 9, 11, 12, and 14. And under enhancing the capabilities of South Africans, we've got those outcomes that are reflected there. 1, 2, 8, and 4. On this slide, in fact, for the next 2, 4, 6 slides. In this first part of the presentation, we just reflect what our midterm review reflects as highlights of progress. And then we've got a slide that captures the key challenges that face the country. And after going through those slides, I'm going to be handing over to Mr. Kruger to then take us through the theme that the... Look what we're doing. The theme that the committee asked us to focus on. So these slides are a reflection of the highlights of progress. And Chair, let me also announce that the midterm review report is been printed as a glossy publication, and we think copies will be ready as early as next week. And then we will also share them with the committee. I think our ministry will share them with the committee. So in terms of the highlights of progress, Chair, and this is a recap. We have shared this with the committee before. Therefore, we're not going to spend a lot of time unless honorable committee members raise questions. The issues we have picked up from the midterm review of performance of government, which we have picked up, the first one is about the improvement in our basic education system, reflected by the improvements in our matric pass rate, also reflected in the improvement in the performance of learners from South Africa in international tests, such as the trends in mathematics and science, as well as SACMAC, and the increase in the number of learners that are passing and gaining a university entrance. As honorable members will see, between the 2 years, up to between 2014 and 2016. Again, looking at the health theme, the life expectancy of South Africans is improving. The Medical Research Council says 63.3 years in 2015. Status A in 2017 says we've reached 64. But also heartening news, Honorable Chairperson, is that the life expectancy of South African women, according to Status A, is now at 67 years. So the NDP says life expectancy should be 70 years by 2030. So we are only 3 years short of reaching the NDP target, whereas we are still in 2017. So which means this NDP target is likely to be met in 2021 rather than in 2030. It will be achieved ahead of time. Maternal mortality ratio is going down, as well as indicators such as child mortality rate and infant mortality rate, they are improving. Members will also be familiar with the fact that 3.7 million South Africans living with HIV are on ART. The state has made progress with the delivery of housing units as well as the provision of social assistance. Next one, John. In terms of the economy, this is a huge area that's facing challenges. Honorable members will appreciate that. But what we've reflected here is what government and the private sector are doing in terms of trying to revive, strengthen, and revitalize our economy. In the automotive sector, what this slide reflects is that the private sector has invested about 12.5 billion rand in total, and our exports have increased to about 171 billion rand between the period 2014-2016, which is the period of the review. In the clothing and textile industry, we've seen about 70,000 jobs being saved and new ones being created. The renewable power producer program has unlocked about 201 billion rand in investments. We've multi-purpose pipelines to transport liquids of fuel between inland and coastal areas have been completed. New locomotives being acquired with the 60% localization content which is required. This slide just shows further factors related to the economy, mostly in the agricultural sector, looking at net farm income for the workers, which has increased, looking at the fact that the restitution claims, about 79,000 of them have been settled, benefiting about 2 million people, 410 households. And the last three bullet points on this slide just shows how our fruit industry is doing, how our vegetable industry is doing, how our red meat exports are performing. In terms of the capable state, we would be the first one to admit that more needs to be done to curb corruption. But what this bullet point shows is that there's progress being made in terms of convicting people who are involved in corruption, where 5 million rands and above of amount is involved. The provision of households with electricity is also improving, with 824,000 households being assisted, over 1 million households being provided with refuse removals, and 1.1 million being given decent sanitation, and households also being provided with a reliable water service. On the international relations front, the new BRICS bank has been established. Tourist figures have gone up. The disbursement of the African Renaissance Fund has also increased to 100 million. On the issue of the percentage of women in legislative bodies, again, we believe more needs to be done, and we also believe that committee members will say to us these figures are not satisfactory. But we note that the percentage of women in legislature has gone up from 38.4% in 2011 to about 41.2% in 2015. We're 8.8% short of this target of 50%. And then again, the gender inequality index reflects gender-based inequalities. It shows some improvement in a sense that the inequalities are decreasing from 0.4 to 0.39, so which is a 4.7% progress. Again, inequality has to be substantially reduced. Honorable Chair, there have also been some challenges that the country and the government have been faced with. The NDP says we must eradicate absolute poverty by 2030 from 39% of people living below the poverty line to zero. But what the data is showing, and the DPME works very closely with Status A, and we report to the same minister, but we use Status A data in our monitoring work. The data from Status A shows that between 2006 and 2011, the income poverty levels in our country decreased. However, they went up between 2011 and 2015. Of course, as our population increased, inequality increased, poverty has increased as well. The most recent report released by Status A is called the Poverty Trends. SA Poverty Trends, and it's a 2017 report. It shows that the number of individuals who are poor has increased by 3.1 million, bringing the total number to about 30.3 million, which means more than 55% of our population is poor. What is also of concern, which is not reflected on this slide, is that the number of people who are receiving social grants, that's 17 million people, is higher than the number of people who are employed. You've got about 15 million people who are employed and 17 million people who are receiving social grants. So it's a situation which is a cause for concern for government, for us, and for all South Africans. The NDP also calls upon all of us to reduce unemployment rate to 6% by creating 11 million more jobs by 2030. But the trajectory has not been very positive. We've seen slow economic growth. We've seen high unemployment rate, which was 27.7% at the last quarter. We've seen high unemployment, especially amongst the youth. The last one is that levels of inequality, as already stated, in South Africa remain very high, with a Gini coefficient of 0.67, even with the social wage, which means without the social wage, if we don't include the social grants, our Gini coefficient is 0.69. But if you factor in the difference that the social grants are making, it comes down to 0.67. So, Jefferson, we thought we'd then start by sketching the picture of areas where progress is being made, but also areas where there are challenges. And right at the end, we will come back to the high-impact interventions that we need to focus on in the last 17 months, as the Chairperson indicated in the Chairperson's opening remarks. With your permission, Chair, I wish to hand over to Mr. John Kruger, who's also been leading our team that's been drafting the mandate paper, to take us through the spending programs and spending areas most at risk.
Madam Chair, so I've just got two introductory slides, and I think what confronts us a bit when we start looking at areas at risk is, in a sense, how we classify them, because different departments and different approaches are used. So here we've actually just shown you, in a sense, the mappings from the NDP. So the NDP talks about the three pillars, the economic services, the social services, and the governance and admin services, the capable state. Cabinet and foresight is organized according to the five clusters. So economic services really have two clusters, and the government and admin services, the NDP classifies, got two clusters. Then Treasury has got a system that they're using at this stage of function group classifications, and we map then that against FOSAD and the NDP, and then we put the outcomes against that. I think there's just a suggestion here that if we're going to understand where government is going, we must talk the same language so that we understand what fits where. So this is just, in a sense, a start to that. The next slide, we've been sort of grappling with your question, what are the programs and areas at risk with regard to budget execution? And we said that really, you know, it could mean six things, or six things couldn't be included there. It's about the threat of under and overspending. But we know there that you receive the quarterly reports from Treasury on threatened over and underspending. So that is really covered by their work. They also, of course, the work of the Auditor General that will look at the financial management and other risks and other more detailed performance risks in departments. And that comes from the Auditor General reports. So the three things that we're covering here, and it's quite a mouthful then, is those programs, departments that are high risk of not attaining the MPSF targets, and Mr. Masilela will come back to that under the outcomes. Then there's the risks in terms of performance management, which is really, we've got a unit that deals with a management performance assessment. And we haven't included there, they assess departments according to the different components of management, financial management, human resources, and so on. And then we've also got, as you know, an evaluation unit, and they run the national evaluation program. So also in this presentation, there are some results from those evaluations, which also focus on certain risks. And then in the mandating process and the budget process, we've been busy identifying a broader set of risks. So from that list, really what we're covering today is what we call these broader set of risks that comes from the budget process, the last one. We're looking at some of the evaluations, and then we're looking at the outcomes against the MTSF target, some of the risks there. So it's quite a mouthful. So I'm just going to launch into then going by the Treasury's function groups into some of these risks. So I'm dealing with the last bullet, the broader set of risks in terms of those function groups. So the first function group that we've got here is community development. And I mean, this is just to give you a bit of context. So it's about 12.5% of the national budget, nearly 200 billion rand. Human settlements is the largest one. Human settlements is one of the large ones. Public transport, and then the municipal equitable share. Now, this area of the budget has been growing at about 2% in real terms. So, you know, there are no cuts there yet. It's still increasing. Population, of course, is also increasing. The demand for services are increasing. But at least the budget has been keeping pace with inflation, and this continues over the MTEF, which we can't say for all function groups. Coming then to the issues, the broader risks, here one issue is the financial situation and the management of the Department of Water Affairs and Sanitation, where there are very large financial commitments going forward on projects not matching the financial flows that we can see. So in the context, especially being in Cape Town, that is of course a very important thing, that we have got huge risks on the side of water provision, and it is important, I think, as the Chair indicated, identifying these areas where we must focus for monitoring and keep our eye on. Clearly the Department of Water Affairs and Sanitation is one. There is what some would call policy uncertainty in human settlement. It's been a long process of reviewing the approach and so on, and there's the delay in finalizing the white paper. So that's an area where we think certainty is necessary. And there's a complex grant architecture there in human settlements. That is one of the set of financing mechanisms we think needs urgent attention. Local government remains a big issue, and I'm sure the committee has engaged with that a lot. But as a broad area, clearly there we need to focus going forward. And once again, coming back to the environment, climate change and so on, clearly we're not sort of confronting a stagnant situation or a stable situation. Things are shifting all the time. And there is a bit of concern that in our community development budgets, which deal with water, sanitation, and those things, we are not explicitly enough making provision for these climate changes and things that we see. So that is a high level, sort of the community development challenges. Coming to economic development, as you see there, it's also a substantial budget of about 242 billion rand in 2017-18. So the large elements really about economic infrastructure and network regulation, so national roads, some parts of our other big infrastructure areas such as water as well, bulk provision and so on. And then there's also employment, labor affairs and social security funds, which is a substantial amount. So this function group has been growing a bit more slowly. Community development, you will recall, growing at about 2%. This growing only at 0.6% in real terms, and a little bit lower over the MTEF. So there's not much real growth here. It's modest. And indeed, some departments are declining over the MTEF. What we show there, the next bullet, is that agriculture, rural development, and land reform, and employment, labor affairs, and the Social Security Fund, they declined somewhat over the MTEF, while economic infrastructure, network regulation, which is more the infrastructure spend, continues to grow in a real term. So mixed fortunes there, but economic development then declining slightly as a proportion of the budget going forward. But I think also, so what we see is not, some might want to call it real austerity here. There's still overall growth in the budget here, although we've had to cut our forward allocations. In terms of the risks here, Mr. Masilela referred to some of the performance in the agricultural sector. So there is a strong agricultural sector. In certain areas of the agricultural sector, we've seen strong growth, strong export growth. And there's some concern that our regulatory system is lagging. Inspection services, food quality assurance, animal health and plant production. And of course, if those services lag, then we face the threat of being excluded from foreign markets. So agriculture, this regulatory system, is a priority also from a budget perspective. Land restitution and land reform, I think people know here that there's been progress has been too slow. The coordination between land restitution and agricultural support has been a problem, and we need to urgently look at that. The third area here is road financing, which we describe it here, the policy as being in limbo. The threat to the toll system means that government will have to find huge amounts of money on budget to maintain our national road system. So there's strong resistance to the toll road system, which certainly some of us see as a very efficient way of funding roads in urban areas. And the absence of that policy really makes, put our road finance at risk and really becomes a risk for some of our public entities that provide those roads. So the uncertainty in the road financing system. I think also what we see, and generally in the area of economic development and funding, we do quite a lot of things, a large number of initiatives here, but overall for economic development and also for the small business strategy, we think the priority is to pull the strands together here. So it's not so much about that we're not doing enough, but it's pulling it together so that it's got more of an impact. There might be too much fragmentation here. Another thing that we've learned here or put here is the issue of community worker systems, where a large number of departments use community-based workers. It's quite uncoordinated. It's got different levels of remuneration, different levels of security. And the DPME is doing an evaluation here to see how we can maximize these community worker systems as a tool for delivering appropriate services, but also create employment. So it's a strong instrument available to government, and we think the focus should be about how we maximize that. And then also in the economic development area, there's the broad area of governance of SOEs, and we just say governance of SOEs, but one must also remember here that there are some state-owned entities that are doing fairly well and are stable. So I think what we must ask ourselves, what causes this downward cycle of some SOEs? And I think one thing where we're concerned, and it comes back to the road financing, is that if your financing policy is not certain, there's uncertainty in these organizations, and then they tend to weaken over time. So we mustn't only say it's a governance problem. If we don't have secure funding and certain funding to these organizations, they tend to go into a downward spiral. So we must look at them as a range of organizations with different levels of management capacity and stability, and we must be careful of only focusing on those that have got the big problems now and not on those that are fairly stable. We must try to keep those stable. General public services, this is of course a smaller budget. The total spending as of this function group in 2017-18 is estimated at about 71 billion, so it's only 5% of government expenditure. And this general public services has been declining from 4.6% in 2013-14 to 4.2% of government spending. So relatively, we've been spending more on roads and social services than we have call it the center of government. And going forward, also, the spending is declining further. So we say the overall decline of 3% per year over the MTEF in, call it the center of government overall. Now, this is not a huge decline per year, and a lot of us think that adjustment is necessary, but we must also remember that salary increases run at higher than inflation. So there's some pain starting to develop in some of these general public services departments. So there are really three elements that we identify in these public services budgets. It's services to other departments, so DPME, DPSA, National Treasury. We help other departments work better, or we should. And then there are services to other departments and citizens, such as international relations, and then also under this general public services we've got the legislature and constitutional organizations reporting to it. Department of Home Affairs, which also provides a very basic services to citizens, civic services, but also the identification system underlie a lot of government. They are currently located in the peace and security group. So the last three bullets there just indicate the different components in terms of spending of this general public services budget. General public services, we don't go into much depth here, but we think there's a bit of an absence of a coherent plan to improve the efficiency and impact of the public sector. And we think this is one area where there are huge technological developments that should be utilized, information and communication systems, data, and so on. And one can really harness those to make the center of government more efficient. And there is some evidence of overlaps, fragmentation, and coordination. And we think this is an important area to be asking, but how over time will we increase the efficiency and impact of the center of government? There's also a census coming up, and that might be a funding issue going forward. The health budget, about 187 billion spending, 188 billion spending here. Health has also, over the past 3 years, been increasing slightly above average in real terms. So one might call it quite healthy real growth, especially compared to many of the other departments. And this pattern continues. So health really maintains its position, increases it slightly as a proportion of spending. And this comes also in the risks again. The bulk of health spending is from provincial budgets, and we know that although they've seen not declining real budgets, the remuneration, the pay of health staff has increased at more than inflation. So there's significant pressure in provincial health funding. So we see that particularly also in vacant posts and trained doctors not finding positions and so on. And we are quite worried coming to the risks, and this is really the last risk under health, that the non-filling of posts because of this budget pressure in the provincial health and sector really is a threat to the progress we've seen. As Masilela has shown, has pointed towards the increase in life expectancy, what we're saying, this has been, this has been great, but we're seeing a threat to that. The other two issues we mentioned here, the first one, medico-legal claims, also a big threat to provincial budgets. That is receiving attention. I'm sure Mr. Masilela can say more about that if you want it. And then also, I think the national health insurance we see as a very critical intervention for not only for social services to our people, but really health system is a huge cost to the economy, and if the costs expand too much there, it becomes a burden to businesses and everything. So we see the national health insurance as a really a key part of our social strategy, but also our economic strategy, and this is moving forward, but we raise this perhaps some warnings about, are we ready at all levels or all spheres of government for implementing this? Learning and culture, there are really two budgets that we look at, basic education and culture. That's about 15.5% of the budget, so really very significant. The basic education budget has been growing somewhat more slowly than overall budgets, so there's still been some real growth, it hasn't been declining, but it is slipping in its relative importance, and that seems to correspond to people's senses, yeah, basic education is important, but are they efficient enough? So putting the pressure on a bit there, and this pattern continues over the MTEF. So in some ways we can say, if we look at the budget and the proportion that we spend on the different areas, we can say that we're prioritizing against basic education. But as I said, other people might argue that they need to find some efficiencies there. Then the other big part, or the other significant part of the learning and culture function group is post-secondary education and training, which takes about 5% of consolidated government spending. And this is, of course, and we referred to that yesterday as well, has been the second fastest growth in function areas over the last 3 years. It's only been second to the debt service costs, which, as the chair indicated, is increasingly putting pressure on our budgets. And over the MTF, you know, post-secondary education and training remains the fastest grower going forward at about 3.2% per year in real terms. The last bullet there just then indicates under this PSET budget, higher education or universities absorb about 53% of that, skills development 30%, technical and vocational education only 14%, and community education 4%. So a significant spend, but there's also the clear indication that there might be issues with a balance, with universities absorbing 53% of the funding, TVET colleges only 14%. So in terms of risks in this area, clearly the one financial issue is about what the Higher Commission will recommend, how government will respond to that. And if we look only at free education for the poor as it is currently defined in the NSFAS, that's about 30 billion risk over the MTEF. In addition to that, the free education one, there is that we believe that for the economic development and to drive employment, we need to spend more on TVET. So there is insufficient funding to expand the TVET system at the rate that the NDP anticipated. The same as in health, in the tight provincial budgets and the increase in the costs of staff, of teachers and so on, we also see this non-filling of posts in provincial education departments and increasing learner-teacher ratios, and that again also threaten the strong gains we've made recently in the education, basic education sector. The last thing refers to the three streams policy, which we see as a curriculum shift, and the NDP sort of very much pleaded for curriculum stability, and we're wondering how extensive this intervention is and whether it puts some of the curriculum stability at risk that we've been having over the last number of years. The peace and security budget, also about 200 billion a year now, defense and security, policing 94 billion, justice system, correctional services, and then as I said, the Department of Home Affairs is also currently under the peace and security budget. It increased very slightly in real terms over the last 3 years and also projected to decline slightly going forward. It's again mixed fortunes. Some grows slightly, justice, corrections and home affairs. See small increases or saw small increases, but going forward, home affairs estimated to decline, as well as defense. So clearly, if we have a real decline, that puts pressures on budgets. So given the real growth, and this starts coming to risk, given real growth and remuneration levels and slow budget growth or declines, budgets are generally under pressure and there are threats of overspending, especially on human resources. So I think here there's more detail in some of the other things, but yeah, clearly overspending on staff because of the slow budget growth here. And then also, I mean, we're just flagging here that we haven't started funding the defense review. So that's, in a sense, a significant funding pressure. Social development is another large part of our budget, 12% or 180 billion. In 2017-18, we include there the employment programs, the social security funds, add to that. Here also, compared to some of the others, there's fairly healthy real growth of 2% per year on this function group. So it maintains its position. In terms of risks, really the big risk that we flagged and that people have taken note of is the payment system for social grants. So we've had a stable system for some time, pays, I think it is now 16 million beneficiaries a month, so it's a huge system that's been working fairly well. There's been modernization and so on, and clearly it's absolutely critical that we keep our eye on what's happening to the payment system, both for the sake of our citizens and social stability, but also in terms of the costs to the budget. So that, Madam Chair, is really sort of looking at some broader risks and areas we think that SCOA should also keep its eye on. I'm going to hand back to Mr. Masilela when we get to the evaluation system and the results from the evaluation.
Chair, with your permission. Well, it's one of them.
Chair, we request permission from the Chair to talk a little bit about evaluations, and then we'll hand over to Dr. Mabohane to do the high impact interventions and then conclude the presentation with the Chair's permission. The evaluation starts on slide 29. Thanks, Chair. What we wish to indicate to the Honourable Committee is that DPME, working together with national departments and provincial departments, has commissioned more than 59 national evaluations, and now covering 143 billion rands of government expenditure. What this means is that the programs that DPME has evaluated have cost government 143 billion rand. And the principle is that you can't continue to spend this order of magnitude of money without evaluating whether you are getting value for money. This is what the DPME has been focusing on. In terms of progress, and I wish to apologize for these abbreviations in this presentation. NEP is our national evaluation plan. So 36 national evaluation plan evaluations have approved reports, meaning finalized table before cabinet. 24 have improvement plans being monitored, and 19 have served at cabinet but are not yet public. So they are public because they've been approved by cabinet. We have 7 provinces, and this excludes the Northwest and the Northern Cape. These are the 2 provinces that are not yet participating in the system. 68 departments now have evaluation plans. And again, the focus of our evaluations is to improve policy or program performance. The evaluations that we'll be covering here are public, and they'll be available at the website that we have reflected, which is the DPME website. The first one, Chairperson, and honorable members, relates to outcome one, which is education, and the outcome facilitator, Dr. Mabohane, who's here. There was an evaluation of early childhood development, or ECD, which indicated the need to widen services to target children within the first 1,000 days, which is conception to age 2, and to target poor children. A new policy on ECD has been approved, and a conditional grant has been created. The challenge is that there's additional resources required for additional services. DPME has also commissioned evaluation of grade R, which showed that the impact is significant in stronger schools and stronger provinces, but not in weaker schools in weaker provinces due to quality issues. There was also an evaluation of the National School Nutrition Program, which shows that government is providing food or nutrition to about 9.1 million learners attending 19,000 schools, which is a major achievement. But the proposals are that we should expand to the richer middle-income schools, which is quintile 4 and 5, if we can get the budget. With the Funza Lushaka evaluation, it shows that new teachers that have been trained with the Funza Lushaka bazaaries are now covering about 15% of the new teachers that are being appointed. However, a need exists to strengthen the placement of teachers in rural schools, again in the weaker areas. There's also an evaluation of the curriculum and assessment policy statements, but this is underway and not yet public. There's evaluations of early grade reading capacity, which is underway, as well as the scholar transport evaluation, which is about to start. And the emphasis is that this is being undertaken on the request from SCOA, the one on scholar transport. With regard to health, the provincial departments of health are participating very actively in the evaluation system. At the national level, there is an evaluation that looked at the implementation of nutrition programs for children under 5. Of concern is that it was found that 25% of children under 5 were stunted. And then in 2017, Stats SA released the South Africa Demographic and Health Survey, SADHS, which showed that, in fact, this number has deteriorated from 25% to 27%. So stunting rates in South Africa are at about 27%, which is a cause for concern. But the implementation of the nutrition strategy is being implemented. We wish the pace could be faster. Safety and security, there's been an evaluation of improvement of forensic services, which found that the investment of 6.2 billion rand has seen some improvement in access to crime scene services, but it needs still exist to address issues such as the high-level withdrawal of cases. There's an evaluation of services to address violence against women and children, as well as the National Drug Master Plan. When we come to outcome 13, we'll touch on this. There's an evaluation that's going to start soon, which is going to look at how the detective services are doing, as well as the social determinants of crime. With regard to outcome for employment, evaluations that have been undertaken include those that focus on the business incentive schemes of DTI, as well as the EPWP. With regard to the DTI business incentive schemes, the evaluations found that these are working and they're cost effective, but there are some overlaps in the functions of our institutions. With the EPWP and Comtuex program, the findings show that these programs are making a difference and can be expanded to provide a wider set of community-based and accessible services. The issue is upgrading EPWP workers to minimum wage, which would have a big impact on the government budget. We'll touch on mining when we come to the environment. Outcome 5 is skills, and again, my colleague Dr. Mawane is the monitoring expert responsible for this area. DPME evaluated the design of the policy on community colleges and made strong recommendations to deal with identified gaps. The revised policy has been presented at the cluster. It's been taken forward, but it's not yet public. In terms of rural development, 6 evaluations were undertaken, looking at the comprehensive agriculture support program, BAFISA microfinancing services. But this also shows that the impacts are limited. Really, the support to emerging farmers in South Africa, it's been a challenge. So Cabinet has agreed that an integrated response is needed. The evaluation of our restitution program shows that it significantly needs to improve its operations and also have increased autonomy. Extension services have improved, but there are still gaps in systems and capacity. The last one, the smallholder evaluation, recommends that there should be better differentiation of support into categories from subsistence to small scale to commercial farmers, and we need to focus on where the greatest value would be added. On human settlements, again, the baseline on informal settlements shows that 1.2 million South Africans are informal settlements, mostly in movement. You know? But only 58% are feeling a sense of security, and only 16% are recognized by the cities. The last bullet point shows that the evaluations found that there's misalignment, the misalignment has to be addressed between the human settlements development grant planning by provinces and the urban settlements development grant, which is done by cities. So between provinces and municipalities, there needs to be better coordination of the provision of housing. For local government, the only evaluation is that of the community worker program, which has been mentioned earlier. Outcome 10, the evaluations looked at environmental governance in mining. In theory, the governance framework that government has is appropriate for good governance. However, there are too many departments that are involved in environmental governance in mining, including environmental affairs, including mining itself, including water and sanitation, quite a number. So there's inadequate implementation and enforcement of the framework, which compromises its efficacy and its ability to ensure environmental sustainability. And very soon we'll be starting with the evaluation of the environment impact assessment. As I indicated, the major gap is around water, which is a big risk to the country. The last part one is on the public service, which looks at coordination, how government coordinates its functions across the 40-odd departments. And the evaluation of the cluster system pointed to the need to strengthen a number of things, including the time spent in meetings, quality of meetings, and implementation of decisions. We've also done the evaluation of the framework for strategic plans, evaluation of the MPET system, which the chairperson was referring to, which the findings were very positive and suggested minor improvements. We've also been focusing on a new synthesis evaluations for 2018, where we'll draw lessons for implementation and work on non-profit organizations. The last evaluation is in outcome 13, the last set of evaluations under social protection. One is the EPWP, which shows that the sector has risen massively from just 175,000 work opportunities in phase one to 866,000 work opportunities in phase two, and an expansion from 5 programs to 22 programs. And that bullet point also outlines what the EPWP addresses at individual level rather than the structural barriers to employment, i.e. lack of experience, access to information and networks, improvement in technical competencies, and others. So stipends are important. They impact on poverty and erode it, but this is affected by late payments, especially in phase two. Now, what is of concern here is that EPWP workers end up using debt in order to mitigate for these late payments, which is not very helpful. The second evaluation is about violence against women and children, and it found that indeed this is a major concern. But many of the services, like the Tutuzela centers, are uncosted, fragmented, and coordination is a major problem despite the existence of interministerial committees. Services are poorly funded, not integrated into departments, APPs. We need to move emphasis towards funding prevention rather than treatment. As Mr. Kruger indicated, that some of the evaluations have implications for the risks, the budget risks. So if we are not funding adequately the services for violence against women and children, that is a budget risk on its own. Then there are similar issues as well on the National Drug Master Plan. It's too high level, not adequately reflected in sector plans or APPs. The last one is the non-profit organization regulatory framework. That evaluation found that data is weak in this sector. We need to scale up requirements to the size of NGOs. We need to increase the number of, we need to improve the efficiency of our registration system. Create one single online registration system so that there can be a single view of all our NGOs. With that one, I'd like to share the last part is just a few slides, about four, for to hand over to Tamabuane, who will also conclude the presentation for us. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, Chukwu.
40, yes, Chairperson. It starts on slide 40. It says, yes, Chairperson, it starts with a strong and inclusive economy. And then there are about four slides that Dr. Mahwane will take us through, and then the last one, slide 45, is the conclusion. Not corresponding? Yes, Chair. From slide 40.
Can we skip other slides when we accommodated the
unions? No, we didn't. We did the risks, and then we did the evaluations.
Okay.
And then we did the high impact, and then we done.
Go straight to page
40. Thank you, Chairperson. With your permission, I hand over to Dr. Mao.
Thanks, Chair. Okay. So these are the proposals that we are putting to saying to accelerate the plans that the country have for the remainder of the from 2017 to 2019. Say these are the things that we believe will actually have an impact in us realizing some of the goals that we have in the MTSF. So for in the strong and inclusive economy. We're saying at the strategic levers that we need to stay on course on implementation of the 9-point plan. And then we also believe that we need to undertake deliberate and open engagements with the private sector and labor to build confidence and trust. And that unless we actually have these interactions and are deliberate, that we don't allow just nature to take its course, that we will be able to actually bring the private sector to play a much more active role in changing our economy. And then we also say we need to also, as part of this, we need to establish relationships between colleges and industry to ensure that the issues of qualifications are addressed. These are important if we want to make sure that that the TVET colleges produce the kinds of qualifications that we need in industry. Then the big one that Mr. Kruger talked about was the issue on funding of post-school education training for the poor. That it is, we need a policy decision and policy clarity for us to deal with this, because it remains a point of conflict within society. And then we say, as government, we can't do all infrastructure, and therefore there is a need for us to engage the private sector to also participate in key infrastructure programs. Then under administrative levers, we say we need to provide water rights to beneficiaries of land reform, and there is a need to develop decision-making processes that simplify land restitution processes and improve handling of operational processes, which are the risks that Mr. Kruger had already indicated before. Develop a recovery plan for classifying the remaining water resources with time frames, and then lastly, accelerate implementation of initiatives for climate change adaptation and mitigation. As we can see, we are starting to experience some of these problems around climate change, so there is actually a need for us to have good plans, but make sure that they are also implemented. Next one. So for capable state and active citizenry, we are saying at the strategic levers that we need to use is that we need to implement and report on progress with an integrated operational plan to fight crime. Develop and implement effective instruments for accountability and consequence management. Prioritize municipal planning and financing towards maintenance and refurbishment of infrastructure. We are losing infrastructure that we have we have invested in, because we also don't look after it after it's done, or budgets are not allocated for it. And then improve intergovernmental relations and enforce cooperative governance principle. As we've been raising that there is a problem of your national, provincial, and your local government in how they organize themselves to ensure that they go always in the same direction and have policies that are actually aligned. And then we also advocate that we need to conclude negotiations around the SACU agreement and pursue national interest through economic development opportunities in SADC and the rest of the continent. We are saying that when we invest, we participate in some of the peacekeeping activities in the continent, we should also be thinking about the economic spillovers or results that we are going to have, so that we just don't only do peace and leave, but actually ensure that business also moves with us. For at the administrative level, we are saying strengthen oversight and accountability of water services authorities and municipal electricity distributors. Implement a new Trade and Investment Africa initiative, and then finalize and implement policy framework for national planning and coordination, and lastly, pursue economic diplomacy in SADC and the rest of the continent. As I indicated, we need to ensure that our engagements with the rest of the countries on the continent also should look at issues of the economy and how we can actually ensure that our companies are participating in these countries. Then looking at developing human capabilities, strategic levers that we are suggesting that we need to focus on is that develop and monitor a migration plan for cash pay master services to an in-source grant payment system. This is following what Mr. Kruger had already indicated as a budget risk, that we need to ensure that this migration is closely monitored. Finalize and implement the National Integrated Assessment Framework for schools, as we know that ANA has been stopped, and therefore if we are introducing a new assessment system, we need to ensure that we continuously advocate and monitor what DBE is doing in terms of having this alternative assessment system. Reach agreement with unions on self-diagnostic assessments of teachers to ensure that our teachers develop themselves as professionals rather than always being developed by someone external. Finalize negotiations on appointments of principals and deputies so that it's done on merit and it's also done on basis of competency. And then implement the transition programs for NHI. And then we also say review and standardize, roll out and systematically expand community-based worker programs, finalize policy on community health workers and mobilize resources for expanding the CHW component and the ward-based outreach teams. Prioritize upgrading of informal settlements through defined intergovernmental relations. And then lastly, incentivize private sector funding for Catholic projects and agree on delivery model with social partners. This is important if we want to unleash funding, that it's not only FISCAS that should be funding this, but if we work closely with the private sector, we can actually find ways of them being incentivized to work in this area. And then developing human capital, administrative levers, is that we need to resolve backlog on title deeds. This is an important thing that we need to ensure that the blockages are dealt with. Implement and monitor and report on localized plans to drive quality based on the assessments conducted by the Office of Health Standard Compliance. Finalize insourcing payment plan for social grants, and then develop policy on the absorption of social workers to enable social work graduates to find employment, because we've invested in training them. Now the challenge is how do we ensure that we also employ them. Chair, for the conclusion, I think I'll go back to, so what we've done is that we've highlighted the key areas of progress towards the NDP. We've also provided a review of progress of specific programs and spending areas that are at risk. And then we've also shown some of the evaluations that we have done that are also, some of them are showing where the risk is. And then we are also proposing some of the high impact indicator interventions that are required for the remainder of the year, of this administration. We have lots of things, but we say if we focus on this, we will start seeing changes in terms of performance of this government. Thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson.
Okay. Thank you very much for the informative presentation on where are we with the steps for all the programs that we commit ourselves to, and also the challenges and the risks and what needs to be done to address. Honourable members, I will now open the meeting for clarity-seeking questions, but also
for discussion.
As a member, if you don't have questions, you can say we are. Come again.
Oh, all right. Honourable Member Manana, Honourable Member Shopestole, in that order.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also thank the presenter. The presentation was so informative. But I would like to pose some clarity questions so that I'm on the same par with you, and there are so many. The first one is on page 21. Under health risk, the medical legal claims on provinces. We once had a briefing with regards to this by Department of Health. What is your take with regards to this matter? The second clarifications that I would like to know. On page 24, the last bullet, we are talking about Department of Basic Education moving on three streams, but policy and impact not clear. Can you clarify this? On page 29, we are talking about provinces who are part of this evaluation, and you indicated that there are other two which are not part. Maybe you can clarify to us the reason behind of these other two not participating. On page 31, bullet number 3, the finding about the 25% of children under 5. Maybe if you can clarify this, because in one of your first slides, you indicated that there is improvement in the mortality rate, in the child mortality rate. Mm. and now we have this problem. On page 31. On page 35. Bullet number 3, the Comprehensive Rural Development Program. I remember when it was introduced, everybody was so excited. But now, if you are saying it's very problematic, the cost is too high. What is all this? Because I remember I once debated raising it. And if you can clarify to me, what are you saying about this? Page 38. You never said anything about these two last bullets. The second last. Maybe if you can clarify to us. And the issue of the NPOs, really it is a great concern to the community, because there are a lot of fraud activities that are taking place with regards to this. The last one, Chairperson, is with regards to the title deed. Exactly. What is the problem? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Member Manana. Thanks for the discussion. Honorable Member Shokestole, to be followed by Honorable Member Mwanyani.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the presenters. You know, this is very helpful to us as people who must be oversight. It has been very difficult on most cases to actually ask questions that are really relevant and helpful when you don't have the information. But I think you have done a good job. On the issue of BRICS, the new BRICS bank, I've been reading a lot about this, the BRICS countries. But I was just wondering, why is it that no department ever mentioned anything about BRICS? And those who write about it, there are two groups. There are those who don't like it very much. They put it negatively as dollar war and all that. But those who are positive, like Professor Joseph Stiglitz, say this BRICS thing is a very good thing, because it's going to actually make the old institution improve and change their bad ways of doing things. This is emphasized especially by Professor Hajung Chang of the Cambridge University. And if there is one thing that myself as a person, as a lawmaker, is going to remember President Jacob Zuma, is the fact that he was able to take us to BRICS. Because we have actually missed being slaves like all the other African countries that have fallen prey to the cruel treatment by the World Bank and the IMF. So I think this is a very important topic that you should actually expand and give us more information on that, because I just got it from reading without being briefed by the departments that should be briefing us on the progress made. But I am very glad that finally it is taking root. On the issue of gender inequality, you know, I am a gender activist more than anything else. If there is anything that I want to spend my life making sure it's happening, is to deal with this inequality, because it's unfair and it's wasting our time. It's wasting talent. People are dying with their talent. I'm glad that you mentioned that we can't leave it to nature. We must do something. We must do maybe yourself. I think you are in a better position to advise the Minister of Women Affairs to actually come with a legislation to Parliament to say that no political party will present and be accepted to for elections unless they've got a 50-50. Because if we keep on wishing and people are not doing that, it's not going to happen. And we are not going to deal with not only gender inequality, but inequality itself, because in the South African situation, the women are more than men. And we're not going to deal with poverty, because when you look at the index of poverty, women are the highest, they're the poorest. So unless we decisively deal with this gender inequality, we may not make a dent. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your input. Honorable Member Sulubanyane.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And thank you very much for the presentation from the PME. Very useful information. The first thing I would like to just speak to and maybe seek some clarity on slide number 14, where you indicate that the budget has been growing by 2%, only the regional and local water services declining in real terms. If you can please speak to that and just explain why that is happening and what is your take when it comes to it, because it would be a matter of concern if, because my understanding or my thinking is that it's one of the areas that actually need to be funded appropriately, considering the local needs of residents. And then with regard to TVET colleges, insufficient funding of TVET expansion and curriculum and qualification issues, which are issues that all of us are concerned about. I know that somewhere you have also indicated that the plan is that you have a partnership between the colleges and the industry. With regard to that, okay, that I think is a very noble position. But in terms of funding, then how do you see us going forward in terms of funding of the TVET colleges? Because there's been an outcry for a very, very long time, and we don't seem to be moving very much in that direction. And then on slide number 30, I think one of my colleagues has also spoken about the issue of the quintile 4 and 5. My question would be that expanding the national school nutrition program to quintiles 4 and 5, have we actually managed to reach out to the high schools that fall under the lower quintiles? Because I imagine that quintiles 4 and 5 learners and parents that probably can afford to feed their children, but my concern would be then the higher classes, the higher grades at school up to matric at schools that fall under the lower quintiles. And then on rural development, yeah, I think it was Honorable Manana who spoke about this comprehensive rural development. because I also would have thought it's the other way around, or perhaps I'm thinking in terms of integrated rural development rather than just comprehensive, because if you have a rural, an integrated approach, then you would have different departments participating, because you can't expect the Department of Rural Development alone. If you use an integrated approach where education will be involved, roads and transport, everybody would then be involved and put in some form of funds. So if you can just please speak to that as well. I think the other issue then would be, where was this? Let me pass this one. This one of violence against women has been mentioned. I think I'll ask the last one. On slide number 43, the issue of prioritizing the upgrading of informal settlements. Where would you place the issue of illegal occupation of land? Because many of these all these informal settlements are not really on land that is reserved which is residential land, but there are illegal occupations of land which is meant for something else. While I, of course, I agree with the upgrading of the informal settlement in those areas. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you for your question. Honourable Member
Tobata. May I go to slide 5? No, 7. First. That's where you talk about the export of red meat, I think. Let's just go there. Yeah. I see that you have omitted this, the poultry industry problem that has arisen from the USA South Africa agreement, which has given rise to problems of survival of our domestic poultry industry, which also gives rise to losses of jobs. I was driving past Camberdown the other day, and I saw this huge chicken company, Rainbow Chicken, are now selling the industry. So if you could speak to that and how it could be addressed, because I think that issue cannot be left unattended to. Slide 8 on the first arrow, the number of convictions on corruption. Chair, I submit that one of the impediments to accelerating that is, for instance, the slow processes in departments, the slow disciplinary processes, which take long time with implicated officials suspended with full pay. Something has got to be done to deal with that. But linked to that is the corruption that goes on in the municipalities. I raise this knowing that you are dealing more with the national department, but I'm saying
very soon and urgently, we will have to factor in the corruption that goes on at the sub-national levels of spheres of government. Because otherwise, we will not be able to deal with this issue of corruption. Officials at that level are beginning to perfect the art of corruption and all the ills that go with it. Slide 10. On the eradication of poverty. I think, you know, when we talk about maybe I misinterpreted what you're saying. In my mind, what probably was happening is that one of the things you are noting is that part of the causes of poverty is the decline in incomes and the decline in disposable incomes, household disposable incomes. In my mind, what we need to do is unpack that. Unpack what causes the decline in the household disposable incomes, which gives rise to rising levels of poverty as well, because it involves, for instance, the increase in the social services, water, electricity, refuse removal. It involves the increase in fuel, which affects the increase in food prices, and other manufactured goods. And you end up with a household which at one point was capable of taking care of itself, but over time it becomes incapable, yet people are still working. People are still earning income, but slowly that disposable income gets eroded and it shifts people down to other levels of poverty. And that I think at some point we raised this issue. I can't recall who we were meeting. Who controls prices in South Africa? Whether you're talking food prices or you're talking prices of clothes, I noticed, for instance, that you know, business is very clever. They know you are not going to allow your child to go naked. You'll do everything in your power to get your child clothed. And so the prices of children's clothes, from nappies to real clothes, has gone dangerously, dangerously high. Business knows that women buy clothes almost every second week. No, I'm not saying it's not something bad. it's really not something bad. In fact, they should do more of that. It's not something bad to buy clothes. The point I'm trying to drive home is women's clothes have become extremely expensive. Why? Because business has noticed this kind of trend. So, and I'm not being sexist. I'm just making an economic point. So, we need to really unpack why 39% of South Africans are poor, and many of whom are living below the breadline. We must equally unpack why 17 million people are receiving grants and only 15 or 16 million are employed.
15.
Because we must begin to talk about deliberate ways which make people unemployed. The deliberate ways which are built into the economy. So, I recall at one point we this committee raised an issue about who controls the prices of property. It was this year. And that causes people to be homeless and therefore demand RDP houses and then force the state to pay to spend a lot of money in providing RDP houses instead of people being able to have to access land, cheap land, to access affordable houses. All of that has got to be, it's a package of things that we need to unpack so that we deal with the real problems that people experience every day. And the real problems which really push people down to poverty. You know what? One point I in my previous life, I was in a meeting with Mr. Tito Mboweni when he was governor of the Reserve Bank, and he says to us, we were a group of workers there, and he says to us, and of course there was business, he points a finger at the business people and he says, stop raising prices of goods and services. Unnecessarily high. Private sector and local government, goods and services. He says to the funeral parlors, stop making funerals too expensive. And weddings very expensive because you are making it difficult for me to control inflation. He was saying to the municipalities, stop raising water and electricity prices. You are making it difficult for me to manage inflation. And for me, that was a telling statement. And we have left those things unattended to. And they have become real, serious economic problems that hit hard on individual households. Slide 4. No. What did I do? Where you're talking about reducing unemployment, I can't recall which slide that is. To 6%.
Yeah.
Sorry, which slide is that?
10.
Yes, slide 10. You know, in this whole presentation where you're dealing with the economy, you're raising very important issues, but very, almost nothing is said about the implementation of radical economic transformation. I'm talking implementation now, not just the theorizing about it. In a manner that points to the reduction of unemployment to 6% and the creation of 11 million jobs. So that state departments begin to openly talk about the implementation of this thing and how it must be implemented, what needs to be done on a daily basis to do this. Because if we theorize about creating 11 million jobs and reducing unemployment to 11%, all the time we meet, we are not going to be able to address the NDP goals that you make mention of here. I know that this committee has begun to ask hard questions about that. It must come from government as well, from the, because it is the departments who have been given the set aside. Whether you're talking goods and services in government, or you're talking what's this thing we're dealing with yesterday, infrastructure, and so on. It's got to be done. What, however, needs to be emphasized in that is the principles of fairness and transparency to avoid these problems that we have of fraud and corruption and so on. Slide 25 on the post-school education and training. You know, the one thing that this committee has been saying is asking for, and it's good that we are talking to yourselves now, is look at all the skills development bodies in the country, whatever they are called, and see whether they cannot be rationalized into TVET colleges, so that all the funds that are lying around in all those skills development bodies can be re-channeled to TVET colleges. Mm. And then you deal with the curriculum of the TVET colleges themselves so that they produce the technical skills that the economy needs. So it is those things that we must really sharpen our minds and our actions on. Because if we have the sitters doing their own things, we have the national human resource development something that was at one point led by former President Mutande, and other skills development bodies that are led and located in the private sector. There's this one which was funded by National Treasury, and its funding was to be added in, I think, 2016. The former Minister Pravin Gordhan reinstated the funding, and it continues now. I can't recall its name.
National Skills Fund.
Yeah. All of that, look at all of those things. Because if we have this left hand doing the skills development and the right hand doing the other skills development, and the head does the other thing and the leg does the other thing, and then we say there is a problem, we have the TVET college, we have a problem. Look, if we strengthen the TVET colleges, really strengthen them, Even the private sector, when they want their workers' skills improved, they can send their workers to the TVET colleges instead of doing something else themselves somewhere. So it's that. Chairperson, I'm taking too much of your time. You're becoming uncomfortable. I'm very sorry. Let me deal with the last one, very last.
If you may round up, I will give you a second round.
The very last one. The very last one on slide 39, social protection and the violence against women and children. I want to propose that there are two things that government must do. The first is to find the source of guns and other lethal weapons. Where do they come from? Because if we have all these illegal guns freely and easily available to everybody, we are not going to solve this problem. Find the source of all those guns. That's the first thing. Find the source of drugs and the drug lords and deal with them. If it means that we must outlaw the private ownership of guns, then let's do that. Other countries are doing it in Africa. Why do we still allow private ownership of these weapons which kill women and children and they assist in perpetrating rape? So, I'm suggesting we look at those things. Thank you, Chairperson.
Just two things from me on page 25. Home Affairs vote is estimated to decline by 5.4% and Defence by 1.1%. I just want to understand the rationale behind this. Just to check on the justification for this movement or for this move. Yeah, let me put it that way. And then the next bullet there, where you talk about growth in remuneration levels and slow budget growth or declines, budget under pressure and threat of overspending on human resources. I'm just looking at a possible solution here. What could be a possible solution on this one? Page 25. One, two, three, four. Okay, now that's fine. And then on page 26. This risk. Overspending on staff. Now, the problem I have is that overspending is an offense. So what have you done maybe to stop this? Because if it's overspending on staff in defense and no transparent strategy to reduce headcounts, I know that at some stage there was a clarion call by the former... it's the former National Treasury, Minister of Finance, to say we must cut down on the admin budget to 6%. So now, here, what is being done? Because this overspending cannot be allowed to go on and on and on. It's going to put us into a very high risk. Actually this department into a very high risk. And the unfunded defense review milestone, can you elaborate on that one? Unfunded defense, because if it's unfunded, then they can't implement So what are we talking about here? Let's see. Page 30. Page 30, the first bullet. Now, in your, I'm trying to look at your findings here. New policy approved with conditional grant. Now, has this conditional grant been allocated? Challenge the funding for the additional services. Now, you see, you know my worry here. Presently, we can see the ECDs are struggling, and of late, it's even worse. The reports that we get, children getting hurt, terribly hurt in the ECD centers, and recently, so many, five children they were banned in an ECD. To me, then it says there's lack of capacity here. So these things are, you know, we're hearing of this for the first time. People have to be capacitated. Now, if you say, evaluation indicated needs to widen services, target children from conception to age 2, or is it, are we supposed to link this to that grade R? No, can't be. I think, no, it's not grade R. Come again?
It's separate.
Hey, this one, we're too quick to move into this one. When we have serious problem with ECDs and your grade R grant. Presently, I know that basic education does not have the capacity, or they don't have the structures to implement the grade R grant. And as a result, there will be an overspend here because they're not implementing. There's no structure and policy on the implementation of that grade R grant. Now we are adding. Shouldn't we wait on this one? Conception to age 2, when children around 5-6 are getting bent and getting hurt in those institutions, one case, conception. I don't know. Maybe I need to understand this one better. I'm looking at conception. Will these people have the capacity? And then if we issue out a grant, will that grant be used in the best interest of those children? Because if there's no capacity, that grant will not be used. And presently, we're trying to look at money being used. We don't want money to go and sit in departments and not being used. We want money, and we want to be able to look at money that is not utilized and shifted to where it can be utilized. So I'm looking at the wisdom of allocating money in this area where there's, I don't know, maybe there's feasibility study done. Because you can't just start on a project without a feasibility study. And can only approve when there's readiness, approved with conditional grant, and that grant, when there is actual readiness, then you approve the grant. Unless if you say, maybe in a progressive manner, hey, you're making noise. How do you tell adults they're making noise? Please teach me a modest way of telling them. So, this one here. I think this one, I have a problem. Let's reflect on this one. Consumption, and people are struggling now in those centers now. The newly born, those children have got right to protection as well. All right. National drug. Now, you alluded to a national drug master plan. Do we have that plan? Well, something else to talk about it. Something else to have it. You must remember, this one is needed urgently because now the drug abuse is becoming a serious problem in our community. And it is impacting negatively on our youth that we are looking up to as future leaders, but also think on health. I don't think health has got the budget to address, and this is going to require. So if we have the plan, then we'll be able to budget for it as well. The drug master plan. Now, page 34. The policy on community colleges. to be honest, I know we're focusing on the TVET colleges, but this area is not getting the attention that it deserves. Now, in your assessment, can you please go deeper into this one? I don't think we're doing well with regard to community colleges, and because in the past it used to be called illiteracy programs. Presently, since it was migrated to the post-CHET, I don't think we're doing well there. Just like it's suffering the same, I think, problems as TVET College since it was migrated to the department. So if we can find a way of looking at how we are doing here, because we need to make progress here as well. Remember, this one came as a result of the, what are those goals?
Come
again?
Sustainable Development Goals.
Yes, this one, it was introduced in response to that, ne? And now we are at another stage. There's a new, there are new goals. So if we MDG, oh yeah, MDG, or now it's yeah. So now it's SDG. So we're not going to meet that goal. So can you look at it as well, and also the budget allocation for it, because there's a high risk here. Actually, we're going back now instead of making a good progress on the illiteracy program to reduce illiteracy so that you can be counted as a developed country. Because this is used, this is the criteria that is used, you know, for a country to move from a developing to a developed country. Now, key evaluations of TVET and underway. The problem I have here, this one is supposed to be prioritized, because here, this one is a hot potato. I have mentioned it in the last meeting to say there's something simmering there. We are sitting on a time ticking bomb there. So if we do not respond, we're going to have a problem. You don't want to have the same situation as the hashtag, please must fall. You remember that, it was too much. You can imagine now if this one also takes the same trend. So if we can preempt or prevent this one from, you know, exploding. Now you say key evaluations of underway. I think this one must be prioritized. TVET, National Qualifications, NQF, the F.
Framework.
Okay, yeah, okay. But the TVET one, I think, and the community colleges. Yes, these are the people have not demanded for a serious report. There's a problem. It's not progressing well. Okay. We will now hand over to you to respond to the issues raised, and I know that some issues were comments, and then where we really need a response, we will then expect you to do likewise. Thanks.
Honorable Chairperson and honorable members of the committee, we once more thank the members for the questions. We divided the labor in terms of the presentation. We will do the same as well in terms of responding to the questions, all the questions that are related to the DBE, basic education and higher education, and TVET colleges. Dr. Mabwane will deal with them. The issues related to the risks in the budget, Mr. Kruger will address them. And then the others will also share amongst ourselves based on the work we do in monitoring and evaluation. Chair, we would like to start with the issues raised by Honorable Umam Manana. The The first one on the medico-legal claims, it is a growing problem. Treasury estimates that 57 billion rands in contingent liabilities it's facing the health sector. So, Honourable Man was asking what is our take on this matter. We wish to say we recognise the efforts and interventions of the sector led by the National Department of Health. One, they have developed a strategy which includes issues of mediation, where they are encouraging that all health departments should first seek mediation between a claimant and the department prior to defending in court the litigation that is advanced. There is a judge who's assisting the department in developing this strategy. They've also adopted the just culture approach from the Department of Justice, which says all adverse events happening in the health sector have to be reported, and the aim is to ensure that these are addressed rather than to punish whoever is involved in committing these adverse events. Our take is that it's still early days. There are best practices from Mpumalanga province. Mpumalanga province is one of provinces that have dealt very well with the issue of litigation by proactively engaging with the litigants and by proactively working towards a settlement outside court, whereas other departments will drag and drag and drag while the costs escalate. So our take is that we note all the efforts that are being made by the sector, but we also believe that it's still early days, and 57 billion rand in 2017 is a lot of money. And we're as concerned as National Treasury is about these contingent liabilities. And we're also aware that the lawyers were involved in the road accident fund. Once government tightened the screws and clamped down on the exploitation of the REF, they've now shifted to the health sector. So we are noting the developments in that space as well. Dr. Mahuane will comment on the three streams of education and our observation that the policy is not yet clear. With respect to provinces that are not part of the evaluation system, the Northern Cape and the Northwest, it was issues of capacity. We found that, number one, issues of evaluation need to be prioritized, even though they are not mandatory. There's no piece of legislation that forces a department to conduct an evaluation of any of its programs. But we came up with this national evaluation policy, which was approved by Cabinet, which then says every financial year, a department shall identify programs to be evaluated together with DPME. But we also need internal capacity within a department to drive these evaluation processes. Of course, we're working with departments to assist them, but in short, it was issues of capacity. It wasn't necessarily issues of funding, because DPME pays 50% of the cost of an evaluation, and then the department pays the other 50%. The link between child mortality and issues of stunting. So, stunting is that briefly as being too short for age, and it doesn't kill. So that is why, even though the mortality rates, child mortality rates are going down, levels of stunting are going up. It is an indication of the nutrition status of children. The evaluation found that in South Africa we focused a lot on the quantity of food, not on the quality of food. And that in South Africa we have not had sufficient dietary diversity. And in South Africa, exclusive breastfeeding rates are very low. That is why increasingly now 25% and 27% of children are found to be stunted, meaning the, I shouldn't talk much about stunting myself because I'm South African. So people like myself and Dr. Mamopane, who are not tall enough for their age, this is a result of the first few years, yes, in those ages. And in fact, in countries like India, apart from the factors that I've mentioned of dietary diversity, quality of nutrition, they found that sanitation as well, issues of water and sanitation, because remember, they give rise to the diarrheal diseases. So a sickly child is not thriving, is not growing. So even if eventually the child is healed from the diarrheal diseases, you'll find that the loss that has happened. It's, good news is that in countries like Peru, programs are finding that, in fact, stunting is reversible. The general consensus has been that stunting is irreversible, but in those, but up to a certain age, of course, amongst children, it is not amongst adults. So yes, so in South Africa, child mortality rates are improving because our children were dying from HIV and AIDS, basically. So with the rollout of PMTCT and antiretrovirus, that has been arrested. The introduction of the new two vaccines, pneumococcal vaccine and rotavirus, has assisted with pneumonia and diarrhea. So our children are surviving. But the issue of being too short for age remains. So, of course, but, it can be addressed, as we have found in Peru, if certain things are in place. Slide 35 about the comprehensive rural development programs. I really wish that the committee could also invite two departments, DAF and rural development, to respond to this matter. The other portfolio committees have invited them. There is a lot of resources, as the evaluation found, that has been thrown into programs like CASP, MOAFISA, and RECAP. But this separation of the mandate of one department being responsible for land and the other one being responsible for agriculture has created challenges, because you can't have land without agriculture. Or you can't have agriculture without land. And if you give people back the agricultural land but they don't get the support that is required, it becomes a big issue. One of the things about the support program was the definition of a farmer, the differences between small farmer, emerging farmer. I think the clear division is that of a commercial farmer. Commercial farmer is very clear. But with the lower categories of farmers, which are mostly black African farmers who are rising and starting up, it's been quite an issue. What the evaluation has found is that really resources have gone into these programs, but the coordination of the support has been quite a challenge. One, on behalf of government, on the part of government, as I've indicated, the overlapping mandates and the adequate support. On the other hand, they've also not been successful in attracting loans from the banks. The banks require collateral. They require a track record. So, and the implements are very expensive. Your input costs, your fertilizers, your tractors, your... So there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of the support, but also the coordination. There's a correct observation that on slide 8, we didn't say much about the Kiama, actually without a Y. It's the Government Immovable Assets Management Act. It's Kiama without a Y. There's this evaluation that GPME has proposed. but which hasn't received a lot of cooperation from the Department of Public Works. That is why we said that there's been a lot of resistance, but we are hoping that in the near future they will allow the evaluation to go ahead. And we're looking at a range of issues there, but it's mostly how government has performed, or the department has performed in terms of all these assets that they're in charge of, issues of lease, visits, freehold, in terms of assets, amongst other issues. The last issue from our list raised by Honorable Manan was the issue of the title deeds. Indeed, there's a huge backlog of title deeds, and the Department of Human Settlements has raised quite a number of reasons, but again, as well, they would be better placed to respond to the committee. One is the bureaucracy, the internal bureaucracy, that they provide the asset, which is the house, but they don't give the title deed. It is 8 different departments which is responsible for rural development, and the Master of the High Court who are responsible for the title deed. So there are internal backlogs in the bureaucracy. They also raised other factors like family disputes about who the title deed belongs to in an RDP house that is allocated to a family with 8 members. And at times the parent is no longer there. At times the parent is there, but the issue is who is the owner of the title deed. So there have been a number of factors. The Northwest Province has had the highest backlog of about 800,000 title deeds. The National Department of Human Settlements has taken over the processing of these title deed backlogs in the Northwest. But I think the bulk of it is this internal bureaucracy. What surprised us was that when the new administration of Johannesburg took over, they were able to fast track the process of title deeds. But what we found was that they followed up the process, the title deeds which were in the final stages of being issued by the previous administration. Those were issued, and then they had a public ceremony of issuing the title deeds. They just issued them to all the applicants. So maybe before we move to the question raised by Honourable Member Shopestole, Dr. Mabuhan, maybe you want to speak to the three streams in the meeting.
Okay, the issue of the three stream, we are concerned because it's being implemented, but there is no policy. So there is they are piloting and whatever, but we, in the public domain, no debates are taking place. We are also worried about the relationship of the three streams model and in DBE, and then what is happening also with TVET, higher education. So we are saying there is lots of duplication that needs to be dealt with between the two departments. And so that's why we are having a concern to say curriculum is being changed. We don't know the impact of what it's going to be, and therefore we need to be raising questions and demanding at least a policy so that we can start interacting with that policy on what is the whole three streams about, because you don't have a policy. It's mainly presentations that you are having, and it's being piloted.
With the Chairperson's permission, we wish to move on to the questions that were raised by Honourable Member Umam Shopestole. On the issue of the BRICS Bank, we fully agree with the view that Honourable Member has raised. We think it's one of the vital institutions, and we agree again with Honourable Member Shopestole that it's one of the legacies that the current administration will leave behind. And we also further agree that it sort of liberates the country from the dependence on IMF and the World Bank. They say we were looking, who were captured by the West.
In
English, not either way. We're slaves of the West. We're now looking east. Because this is where the other countries are coming from, you know. So, indeed, we support the views expressed by the professor that if this institution were to attract the types of investment that it wishes to attract, we would see much more advancement. Because the aim is that this bank should attract investment and that the development of Africa, as we've seen with the agreement between South Africa and China, should be financed from this institution at very, very reasonable lending rates than has been the case with the other institutions which have been financing projects in the rest of the continent, as I mentioned, the World Bank and IMF, which when you are unable to pay, they initiate the regime change.
Yes.
Yes, me too. So yes, we agree with the with the honourable member, and we're working very close with DPME, with DERCO and other relevant institutions in monitoring how the evolution of the bank is taking place, and we could also bring our colleague responsible for outcome 11 to deliver a detailed presentation to the committee. Chairperson, we also fully agree with Honourable Member Shopestole about these issues related to gender inequality, because indeed the Constitution makes a provision, but further to the Constitution, a department must then initiate the legislation that gives expression to the constitutional provisions. And we also wish to apologize for bringing an all-male delegation to the committee. In fact, our Director General, Chairperson, was presenting our annual report yesterday to our portfolio committee. She was heading the delegation, but it was all male, né? Dr. Mabuane. Yeah, so we got into trouble as well yesterday. So we wish to apologize. But we are taking home this message of this legislation that seeks to promote gender parity and ensure that it moves beyond principles into actual implementation. So we fully agree with the issues that Umam Shopestole has raised. I think those were others. If we've left out, Umam Shopestole will remind us. Chair, with your permission, we wish to move on to the issues raised by Honourable Members Nokonya. And these really speak directly to issues that Mr. Kruger raised in the presentation. And I'm going to hand over to him. Well, Dr. Mahwan will talk about TVET colleges. Over to you, sir.
As you'll see, this presentation ranges very widely, and you've got a relatively small delegation here. So while some of the analysis I've been involved in, I don't know the detail about the decline in regional and local water services, but indeed, as the member has indicated, it flickers a warning light here, because we have this huge pressure around water services. So it is a concern and something where we also have to dig deeper. So I think so what I'll undertake is to dig a bit deeper here with the relevant analysts and with the National Treasury and see what we can say. Is this, call it a technical adjustment, as they sometimes talk, or is this a real indication of a problematic trend? And then we'll have to come back to the committee on that. So on 22, there was the issue of insufficient funding for TVET expansion linked to the issues of the partnership, and how do we then proceed. Shall I go ahead with that one?
Yeah.
So I think the member raised quite relevant issues here, because this is also one of those areas where we know that there's a need for moving forward on funding. We know that part of our unemployment problem with young people is the insufficient funding we offer in our TVET colleges and so on. So there's a need to expand, and both the white paper, the NDP speaks to that. And that funding is not there at the moment to expand that dramatically. The problem, however, is also that, I mean, whether one calls it policy issues or curriculum issues, or also still exists, that we know that the DHET is still offering two curriculums in the TVET. There are complaints about the relevance, the quality, and so on. So, and that's where the issues of partnership come in. So, you know, our sense here is very much we need to fund more, so this has to stay high on the budget agenda. But at the moment, one feels that there is also some clarity that needs to be reached about the curriculum and the policy there, that we don't seem to have hit a situation where we're happy that we've really got a credible and quality curriculum, and then the ability to implement such a curriculum. So I think, you know, this is sort of a big issue, a big risk issue to focus, and, you know, I don't want to say sympathize, but be with our Department of Higher Education and acknowledge, yeah, for the rapid expansion that is envisaged, the money's not there, but then also say, you know, you'll have to show us a bit more of a certain strategy if we are to expand quickly. I hope Dr. Mabuhwane can take us on the expanding the National School Nutrition Program, where I understood the question of saying you're going to quintile 4 and 5, but what about poor high schools?
Chair, I would like to add on the issue on the TVET with a question that was asked later about why don't we rationalize all the funding in terms of skills development into the issues of TVET, so that it deals with the same issue. To say, as part of the exercise when we're doing the budget mandate paper, we did explore the issue of saying levies being directed into your TVET colleges, but the issue was the legislation does not allow for that. And so there's a legislation issue that we need to deal with on how do we rationalize them and ensure that funding is also available to your TVET colleges. Because labor needs to agree, industry needs to agree on the use of this money into training of these students. So there's a legislation issue and an agreement issue that we need to deal with it. Currently, with the three colleges, we've been using some of the money from the skills levy to help with the building of your colleges. But as I always indicate, it's not sustainable. We do need a sustained income for these three new colleges that are coming online to ensure that they remain operational. Then on the issue of your quintile schools, the reason why the 4 and 5 is that it has also become clear that communities are changing. Remember, the quintile focuses on where the school is, but usually the learners who come to those schools, they are usually not coming from that area. So we've been seeing where your former colored areas. The schools are much more empty. They are your quintile 4, but the learners are coming from your squatter camps, actually coming into the school. So there is now a need to say there is a need to provide food for them. And then for high schools that are in quintile 1 to quintile 3, they are being provided already with the nutrition. Now it was just saying for the 4 and 5, especially where you have poor children who are coming into these schools, we do need to find a way of providing for their nutrition in those areas. Thanks.
The
There was a question about rural development and the role of different departments. We wish to confirm that indeed rural development is not only being assigned as a responsibility of rural development and maybe land and agriculture. In fact, in outcome 7, honorable members will note that there are so many different departments that are involved. The Department of Health is tracking the delivery of healthcare services in rural areas, and they report on a quarterly basis when you go to cabinet about what has been done. The Department of Basic Education looks at infrastructure in rural schools, and they also report consistently on what is being done to improve infrastructure in rural schools. Then you'll also find departments such as DTI and all the other economic services department, DPE, DTI, small businesses, also reporting on what opportunities are being created in those different departments. The lead and coordinating department is the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, assisted by the Department of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries. That is why the evaluations have raised this issue of the overlapping mandate as a key challenge, because those are the two lead departments. But other than they being the lead departments, indeed, there are different departments that are contributing. And in our outcomes monitoring report, we report beyond the work of those two departments, but we expand to the work of the rest of other departments. And again, the last issue was about the upgrading of informal settlements versus the issue of illegal settlement. And we also wish to indicate that the Department of Human Settlements focuses on the approved settlements for upgrading. So there is a separate process of dealing with illegal settlement which involves law enforcement. But those approved informal settlements are being upgraded. The challenge is the progress that is not as fast as we would have liked it to be. Chairperson, the next set of questions were raised by Honorable Member Gwabaza, and with the Chairperson's permission, we wish to move to those ones. Would you like to deal with the issue of the free market economy controls prices in South Africa? Maybe shift that. I will add. We'd like to start with the one that pertains to the free market economy and who regulates prices in South Africa. Mr. Kruger will start. He will deal with the rest.
Thanks. The committee, I think very valuable questions are being raised here, and it is indeed also in the NDP. There is a lot about the package of services that South Africans deserve and should have access to, but then also the cost of living and the cost of those package of services. And I think what we're very much aware, and the NPC is aware of, that you can help on the cash side, try to get people jobs, try to make sure that your grant system responds to the patterns of poverty, but if prices change dramatically and so on, then you wouldn't have made any progress. So that you cannot only work on the income side of people and really on the employment side, there must be a proper regulatory system in place. And I think there are a number of regulatory systems that are relevant here. We have seen the Competition Commission making progress in looking at different sectors and sort of, in a sense, breaking the cartels and so on. But I think all of us are agreed that the structure of South African industry is very concentrated and a lot more work needs to be done there. So while one applauds the Competition Commission and progress there, more is needed there. There's a recent investigation into the health sector, and of course that also, what we have to pay for our health services, also impact on a range of things. So it's a competition infrastructure, It's about food regulatory system and so on. So I think, you know, here from the DPME, we are supporting the NPC to do some more work on the cost of living, and the NPC has recently received from the TIPS program an updated study on food prices and the cost of living. But I think the member is sharpening our attention that, you know, more is needed there, and that ties indeed to your other question about radical economic transformation. So if ownership is so concentrated and industries are so concentrated, it would be very difficult to get this transformation. And yeah, so I think the member alerts us to an important thing which we haven't perhaps incorporated enough in our reporting and so on, and that we'll keep in mind. But as I say, the NPC is continuing to focus on that. I think on the radical economic transformation, it is, as you indicated, there seems to be a lot of lip service and not engaging with a concept in detail. In our work on the budget, we've been trying to think how this fits into the whole thing, and I think indeed the mandate from Cabinet to develop this prioritisation and mandate paper comes from the dissatisfaction that the budget is not used sufficiently to transform the economy, and that's not only what government buys and the services, but also who it buys from. And you'll know that there's the progress there on the procurement strategy. We've also been indicating that we must, through the budget, indicate how the budget changes the ownership of assets really in the economy, and that it's about a range of assets. It's not only the land and physical assets, but it's also the human capital, the social capital, and so on. So we are trying to incorporate that perspective by focusing a bit more on radical economic transformation means a shift in the ownership of assets, and how does government promote that. And indeed, the title needs fit in there, because you have got, I suspect it's millions of South Africans who have got access to homes but do not have the full legal title, and that hampers their use and their leverage of those assets and so on. So in that sense, we are trying to incorporate this notion and really operationalize this notion of what does radical economic transformation mean, and how we sharpen the budget to deal with that. I think Dr. Mabuchwane has spoken about the skills development bodies and the rationalization there. Then we had the issue of violence against women and the sources of guns. I don't know.
Yes,
will you deal with that?
Dr. Mabon, you want to give it to me?
We've done it.
Yeah, okay. So this issue of, I just want to make one short addition. All the members have raised very powerful questions. And in response to each question, we could do a separate presentation providing all the details. And, you know, so it is very stimulating and enriching, as Mr. Kruger is saying. Why I'm making that point, Chairperson, is that our minister had delivered the presentation at the February Lekgotla of Cabinet. The theme was radical economic transformation. And it was a detailed presentation where he went into each of the levers available to the state. One of the things he raised was the issue of licensing. And he was saying, we are the ones who license all these entities in private sector, whether it be mining companies. We issue mining rights. We issue water rights to farmers. We issue all sorts of rights. Why can't those rights be converted into aspects of radical economic transformation? Why can't those rights be used to change the systems, the processes of ownership in South Africa? He listed JSE ownership patterns and reflected the minuscule, very small proportion of JSE listed companies that are owned by black South Africans. We went on to talk about the issues of how do we enhance the JSE ownership. We've got IDC, Industrial Development Corporation, which is supposed to be developing entrepreneurship. We've got this new initiative from the DTI, the Black Industrialist Program. How are we doing with the Black Industrialist Programs, and what are the obstacles for us reaching? He spoke about different types of levers that are available to the state, and we went into detail about each of those levers and how each of them could be implemented. One of the things that needs to be improved is the transparency. Transparency, because for instance, when we asked from DMR about a very detailed report as to who has what shares in what mine in South Africa, and what is the percentage ownership and the BEE status, that was not forthcoming. So if we had changed the patterns of ownership in South Africa, we must also improve on issues of transparency. And those are some of the key messages that our minister raised when he was delivering this in general. So that presentation is there. We can share with the honorable member. But like I'm saying, each of the questions raises. Chair, honorable Tawada also raised a very important point. I think Mr. Kruger started to speak to that about the issues of disposable income. How do we unpack the decline in household disposable income? And its relationship to poverty. And, the Stats SA released this report earlier in 2016, which looked at household incomes. On that slide there, you will see that we still have a lot of work to do. Households that are headed by men in South Africa, their average income is 165,853 rand. Households that are headed by women, their average annual income is 98,000. So before you talk about expenditure, just the income, you already have inequality. That's the first point. And that inequality, the first aspect is based on gender. And this is what Status A found. The second aspect was in terms of race. Status A found that white-headed households spend 5 times more than black African-headed households and 3 times more than the national average. So as you can see on the slide, the average income of white households was 444,000. And the average expenditure was 350,000. But when you come to black African, the average income is honorable chair per annum. This is the average. So they've taken the high income earners and the low income earners. They've come up with the average. The average income of a black African headed household was 92,000. And the expenditure was 62,000. So again, that's what I was saying. Each of the questions that the honorable members raised, could be a presentation on its own. But the inequalities in South Africa are in terms of gender, in terms of race, and urban versus rural inequalities. And they start at the level of income, even before we go to expenditure. And I think it also links to the earlier question Honorable Gawaza raised about radical economic transformation. These are structural issues. Structural meaning deep-seated and which require long-term interventions and types of... So to say could also come and present this to the committee in detail, but they shared this information with us when we needed it for a different purpose. Honorable Member Gawaza is correct that there was an omission of the poultry industry in the presentation. Of course, the devastation that has happened from avian flu is significant. And we know the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries is leading the response, working with other departments such as health and so forth. And they have shared with TPME a report that you could pass on to honorable members. We just focus on the red meat industry and the gains that are being made in the export industry. But we do acknowledge the big challenge coming from the poultry industry with hundreds of thousands of chicken being culled in our country. And indeed, as Honorable Member Kwabata says, the loss of jobs, the loss of incomes with industries like Rainbow Chicken being hard hit. I think the other issues we have addressed, Dr. Mahwane, you dealt with the issue of the skills development and the task team that is headed by the deputy president. We also agree there about the issue of finding the source of guns and other illegal weapons, and also finding the source of drugs and other. I think stretched as our law enforcement agencies, these are the areas that are of priority. There's a recently approved integrated operational plan to fight crime, which was tabled before cabinet. And I think it is important that you assess, Mr. Crooker, whether these matters are being dealt with adequately. I was saying recently, the South African Police Services, the NICOC, National Intelligence Coordinating Committee, and the State Security Agents brought before Cabinet an integrated operational plan to fight crime, which has six pillars ranging across social aspects up to law enforcement, up to the justice system. And I think it's one of the areas in the plan. We would go back and assess the extent to which it covers the issues that the Honorable Kwabata raises. But again, if the committee wanted a fully detailed presentation on how country seeks to deal with these issues, it's there. The plan is there. It's been endorsed by Cabinet. Chair, with the Chairperson's permission, we then move on to the questions raised by the Chair. Shall we? The first one, Mr. Kruger, will deal with, or maybe you've dealt with, is the issue of the decline in the budget of Home Affairs and Defence. Is the one that you tackled earlier?
Yeah, I haven't really tackled that. And once again, I mean, it is. They are trends that we have identified in analysing the budget at a fairly high level. So we'll have to dig in a bit more detail there and come back to you, because certainly that the Home Affairs is flagged, because we see Home Affairs as one of the fundamental building blocks of our democracy. Indeed, the civic services form the basis of identifying citizens. That forms the basis of our grant system, of our education system, and its monitoring and so on. So we raise the concern there, and we're not quite sure what's responsible for that. So it is flagged, and there I'll also come back to the Commission. The defence and the whole issue of human resource spending, people will know that with the declines in revenues, we've got government revenues, we've got huge pressure on our fiscal framework that we need to maintain in order to stabilise the debt situation and stabilise the fiscal situation. So also on the human resources side and the plans in the different departments of maintaining within their spending ceilings there, we raise this issue, and I think as an area to focus on where we don't have the answers. We do seem in the case of defence and a few other departments that there seems to be a bit of lack of forward movement. That's between the Treasury and the DPSA, which must really generate the options to help defence, and defence, of course, there seems to be a bit of a stalemate, and that it seems to be a threat to our fiscal framework and sticking to our fiscal framework. So I think it's probably an area where it would be helpful also for the committee to dig a bit further with DBSA and Treasury and how they are assisting the Department of Defense, and I think also for the Department of Defense, we know that, you know, human resources budget that is under pressure is not an easy thing to deal with. It's also got implications, political implications and other things. So I think between the team here, we haven't got more of the detail, but this is something that was flagged in the budget process and we think is an important thing for the committee to look at. Yeah, the defense review is just flagging the issue that there's been a defense review. It's got a number of levels of levels of implementation of a strategy, and there's one basic strategy, which is the phase one, and that is not funded at this stage, and the implications of that is very much about where you come from. So some people might say that that is not a bad thing. The defense must just live within its means, and it can cope within its means. We know that the defense system is warning us that at some levels they're in a downward spiral, and if we don't arrest that, there will be negative repercussions. So this is sort of also one of those budget risks that we flag, and given the current fiscal resources, we haven't got much of a specific way of dealing with it. So I think that's where the country has to assess, is the current spending on defense and going a bit less, should they live within the means, and is that give us enough of what we want in terms of services, or is this over time becoming more and more of a threat to the country, which we should, as we move forward in mandate papers in the years, keep high at the list. Because defense also, of course, points to a lot of protecting our coasts, our borders, and how that has economic implications again in a number of industries. So it is unfortunately one of those difficult issues where we have to weigh, where we realize the need to stay within our means, but also that there are probably investments that are becoming more urgent. I would like to consult a bit with our outcome facilitators that are responsible for these areas before I leap in here. So I've got it marked in red, and we'll respond to you on those in writing. Thank you.
Chair, on the ECD question that was raised to say why the 1,000 for the first 1,000 days, so we are putting more burden on a system that is struggling. The evaluation, when it was done, it was basically to say there are problems with the first children before they reach basic education, and as Mr. Masilela has already indicated, those issues of stunting they are a problem. And the research is showing that actually when the first days of life are important if we want to help with the neurons development, stimulation, and all of that is important. So our children, when they reach school, they are already disadvantaged because we have not taken care of them. The 1,000 days is not only a basic education, it includes social development, it also includes health. It's important that they need to coordinate and support our children to ensure that by the time they reach school, they're actually supported to be able to compete at equal footing with everyone else in the country, so that the poverty should not be the determinant of whether you are going to succeed in education. We agree that grade R is still a problem. As we've indicated, that our evaluation shows that they do for your quintile 4 and 5. Actually, you can see the difference that it's making. But with the quintile 1 and 3, we are struggling because it's not only the problem of grade R. It's the fact that our schooling system is not able to take advantage of what they get and use it to improve. So we've been arguing that yes, we need to strengthen your grade R, but while you're strengthening your grade R, you also need to be thinking of the kinds of children that we are going to be receiving. So your issues of stimulation becomes important. Those kids, when they get to school, they need to have already been stimulated, been trained in their motor skills, so that they can really be ready to take advantage of what the education system is providing. But it's still an important issue that we can't just say now we want this 1,000 if we have not actually started setting systems correctly. And issues of coordination between the three departments is still a problem, even affecting the extra year that is required for your pre-grade art. Thanks.
Chair, just in support of what Dr. Mawane is saying, I'm agreeing with him. We also acknowledge what the chairperson has said about children getting hurt in ECD centers. And we've seen the media coverage of this, especially I think most recently was in Gauteng. And also agreeing with the chair on the issue of capacity, that indeed capacity is not adequate. I think, Chairperson, we can say in the last 23 years of democratic rule in South Africa, one of the things government has struggled with is the balance between access and quality. You can take any issue. You can take health, you can take basic education, you can take ECD. The challenge has been balancing access with quality. Now, the Chairperson was saying, why are we expanding access when the quality of the current services we have is not adequate? And the expansion of the access is based on the principles that Dr. Mabuane has raised, that the NDP talks about the first 1,000 days and the need to improve cognitive development in that early stage. But the chairperson is also spot on. What do you then do about quality? Because it has been exposed even in the media that in the existing services, we are not yet providing the quality of services that we want. And the example the chair has given of children getting hit. One of the things in the ECD policy is the training of the ECD practitioners. Appropriate training, and that not anybody can be placed in charge of children. People have to go through a formally recognized training program. And the one thing that the Department of Social Development has tried to do within the limits of their capacity is to investigate and visit some of these ECD centers, also assisted by the municipalities, to check that they are appropriate to take care of South African children. But the chair's point, again, is valid capacity. You know, how many can you visit in 365 days in a year? We take that point. But we're also saying that there's a balance between access and quality. You know, how do we get it right? In some places we get it right, in some places we don't, you know? So there is a national drug master plan. There was one that ran, I think, from 2007 to 2012. And the one that was evaluated. And there's a current one that has just been adopted. And this evaluation focused on the previous National Drug Master Plan. And Chairperson also raised an important point as to whether we have an adequate budget for implementation of this. And resources are always a challenge, but what we found to be an even greater challenge is the coordination between different departments. And the coordination does require additional resources. It just requires a willingness for all of us to work together. And the evaluation also found that this issue, the Central Drug Authority must be independent. It must not be part of a department or of government, so that it can be independent and strong and objective in offering its recommendations to government. The last two were about the policy on community colleges. And Dr. Mawane, I think you also need to elaborate. DPME was requested to brief the Deputy President on TVET colleges, and that briefing was done by Dr. Mabuane. It was an extensive briefing, but I think it's giving the committee snippets. It's just giving the committee snippets. Maybe he needs to try to elaborate and maybe draw on that briefing he was doing to the deputy president, and maybe also come back to the committee, you know, to deliver the same briefing that he was doing to the deputy president. But through the chair's permission, I'm going to ask Dr. Mabuhane to return to this area, talk about the policy on community colleges, and again, TVET colleges. As the chair said, we don't want a fees must fall scenario in TVET colleges. Over to you, Doc.
Chair, you'll have to direct me. I had to run because I've been taking too much water, so I didn't hear the question. So I'm assuming that the question is about the policy on community colleges.
Yes, the chair said the TVET colleges are not getting the attention that they deserve, and then we're not doing well with community colleges, and the issues of integration of these community colleges. And then on the issue of TVET colleges, the chair said, how are we prioritizing the funding of TVET colleges so that we don't have a similar type of uprising, the FISMAS fall uprising.
Thanks.
I'm not misquoting the chair.
The community colleges, I agree, they have been treated as a stepchild of DHET, and we can see in terms of progress, the policy of setting them up, operationalizing them, they are far behind compared to when we DHET took over the colleges from provinces, because that caused problems also when they inherited them, trying to equalize salaries, making sure that the contracts are the same. That has brought internalized problems that were in the provinces, and now they've become DHET problems. And some of the provinces actually signed contracts knowing that they are going to be, DHET is going to inherit those problems. So with the community colleges, we've been, just the part of the policy itself being set up has taken much longer than we thought it should take. So if in terms of performance, you will see we always put them as red, that there is nothing that is happening in terms of the targets that are in the MTSF. And then on prioritization of TVET colleges, in terms of priorities of the putting your TVETs in terms of the funding, we have been raising it as a concern that in our response to the fees must fall, because they were much more organized than your TVET students, the focus has actually been on your universities, and there is actually seeds of discontent among students in your TVET colleges who feel that they've been neglected, and that's what we've been dealing with, trying to encourage DHET to focus more now on your TVET colleges. One of the issues that DHET raises is the fact that the funding, which is supposed to be 80%, gets funded, and then the colleges have to raise 20%. Because of the pressure on NSFAS, colleges have had to use their money to fund more students, and therefore it has reduced that 80% to around 60% or 50% of what actually they should be getting as for each student. And the consequence of that is that infrastructure is falling apart. The consequence of that is also that programs that are supposed to be putting more money, like your workshops and at improving those workshops, those are suffering because all the money now is being put in ensuring that students get funding and they don't cause problems for your TVET colleges. But in the terms of the MTech, I know that they have put in the issue of saying they need more funding, especially to cover your poor students in the sector.
Honorable Member Banana.
Chairperson, there are so many follow-up questions. When you listen to them, you get more knowledgeable and more information is coming out, you know?
That's why I've opened this time for follow-up questions.
Okay. Coming back to the TVET. Chairperson, I think the first and the most thing that we need to do as South Africans is to change our mindset, all of us, because there is that belief that if you attend TVET, you have an inferior education rather than those who went to the university. And that thing is a stigma on its own.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how can we change it, because most of the South African, if you said I have a diploma from TVET, they are not taking you very serious. Even when you want employment, they would like something from the university. So I don't know how can we educate our communities that the education that is there from the TVET, it is important like the one that is from the university. I would like a comment from the department. How can we change those things?
I just want you to elaborate on the 30 billion. You said HERA Commission recommendation, and then you said 30 billion. I know that report is not yet out in the public domain, but already you are touching on something that might have an impact on the budget. You know? So that's why I want you to just elaborate on that one. Honourable Member Shopestol, no follow-up questions, you are happy?
No, Chair, I just want to suggest that they should come to us more frequently than they have been doing.
I think that is an arrangement that we have now, to say when we also sit with committees, if they can just send one or two people who would have relevance to that committee and then come and assist us with adequate responses to issues that will be raised.
Juan, do you want to go on TVET?
Yeah,
because I think, I mean, just one comment, that Dr. Mabukwane has also been visiting some colleges and so on. So I think there is also a danger here that as South Africans we don't value the excellence, you know, that there is. So that the TVET college sector is also a mixed sector, and there are people who have got interesting programs and so on. And I suppose, you know, as a monitoring department, we also have to do more about showing that it's the same with the state-owned enterprises. Not all of them are in a crisis in a basket, because some we've managed to make quite strong and so on. So I think, you know, my contribution on the TVET colleges, we mustn't be totally despondent, but certainly we've got to work on quality and the perception of quality there.
Thanks, John. Yeah, I agree that, I mean, we are always trying to tell people that you can't paint them in the same brush. There are those TVET colleges that are actually making stellar work, and people are actually getting employed. There's demand for people coming from certain of these TVET colleges. Our problem is that we've not really, as government, we have not supported or made people aware of these of these ones that are functioning, as a way of saying these are lessons that can be learned. And being on that, we've also learned that it's also the issue of administration, that if you have a good administrator in that college, you can see the impact that it has. And those are administrators who don't sit and wait for DHET. they go out, form these relationships, go to the sector that they want to specialize in, make sure that there is a working relationship with them. Even those that are in rural areas, you find that they find ways of saying, how can we work with your spa, with your checkers to train people who are going to be packers and whatever. And once those industries see the importance when they are trained, they really love those students. So while on the other hand you have those college principals who are just sitting waiting for DHET, and in that you can see in terms of performance. I think it is true, we don't communicate, and then we also need to change our minds also as government. In terms of when we advertise, we never advertise for anyone with a, it's very rare that we advertise for someone with a TVET qualification. And so that means we ourselves as government, we need to also be having this mind shift of saying, there are skills that we need in government that we can tap in from your TVET colleges, so that when people start seeing that actually you do get successful people coming from these institutions, we will be they will become much more famous. Last week or 2 weeks back, they were issuing certificates of best performing TVET colleges, and unfortunately, I didn't see it on TV. Something on how do we communicate? It's like everyone is ignoring that sector, and they only want to come when there are challenges. On the Hair Commission, Chair, we don't have the report. We don't have the privilege of knowing what is coming in the report. We are still waiting. But we already know, Chair, that just responding on the, from the, what do you call it, the ANC's recommendation of the 150,000, that is going to cost more just to meet that 150. So we've been trying to come up with models to say how many billions is it just going to cost us just to do that 150 policy recommendation. It's more money. And to even take it now to the 600,000 that the students were demanding, it's going to be quite a challenge. But we have not done those models much more clearer to know how much it will actually cost. And the issue of bursaries versus loans. It's also another issue that we need to deal with. Who gets loans and who gets bursaries as part of saying we need to sustain how we increase access. And then lastly, Chair, is the issue of recouping. Because if we are able to recoup money that has been given, that means it gives us more sustainable. It does not always have to be money that we have to source again from a treasury. But at this rate, it seems no one is necessarily interested in the issue of recouping. And so the sad part is that we also have public servants who are owing NSFAS, and we are not pursuing them in terms of ensuring that they pay back their money.
Just in brief, very brief, in addition to what you, in addition and support of what Dr. Mabwane said, we actually like the challenge that Honorable Manana is throwing at us. As government broadly, not just the PME, how do we work together to change mindsets? And I think Dr. Mabwane touched on the issue of raising the profile of these colleges. And I think going back to meet with GJS as well at some point. Training is a means to an end, and the end is either employment or self-employment or entrepreneurship. So how are we going to market TVET colleges as viable training institutions that South Africans are going to want to see what happens at the end of the training? And that speaks to the placement of the TVET college graduate. And I think was it 16,000, the last count?
Yeah.
It's a point I'd like you to come back to. The issue of the placement of the graduates of TVET colleges, because that indicates the confidence that industry has, or even
in this training system. And Dr. Mawan has just touched on the issue of government confidence. But I'd also like him to come to the issue of the placement of his colleges. Chair, the Ministry of Higher Education and Training was presenting here in Parliament during the POA quarterly reporting cycle. And they indicated that one problem, maybe two problems which are integrated into one. The issue Dr. Mahwan was raising about the delays in issuing certificates to the TVET college graduates. The minister indicated that he discovered that there are 8 exams annually in TVET colleges. And that means the backlog is actually generated by the system. In that if you're going to conduct 8 exams per year, do you have capacity to certificate all those that are going to pass for that particular year and issue those certificates urgently? So he said one of the things he's looking into is reducing the number of these exams, maybe rationalizing them, reducing the number of these exams, and by so doing also contributing to improving the efficiency of issuing the certificates, because young South Africans can't get frustrated waiting for a year or two just to be issued with a piece of paper. And Dr. Mawan has said that the letters from the institution that confirm that a trainee has passed sometimes are not accepted by industry. They want the proper certificate. So I'm just saying we accept the challenge and we work with our partners in GCIS and others, but internally as well, the efficiency that we must improve so that these colleges become attractive. Because at the end of the day, people are being trained so that they get employed, or that they employ themselves, or that they employ others. But that has to be done. Thank you, Chair. Dr. Mawan.
Short is that, Chair, some students, the reason why they don't get their qualification because they never had job experience, leadership. And this is a challenge that we've been trying to battle with, say, DHET needs to find creative ways on how do we deal with it. Some of the colleges that we visited, they are actually coming up with innovative ways of doing it in terms of saying they have simulations, and then they simulate industry, and then they ensure that they practice within the college itself. The placement of students is a challenge with the economy that is contracting, Chair, that companies are now becoming reticent to bring in, because when you bring in someone who's learning a new job, there are problems in terms of like sometimes things get break or whatever, so they rather not include them. But what we are trying to say is that actually if you train that person, it's easier to recruit because you've seen them over a long time, so you know where the kind of a person than a person that you are seeing on a CV. And we've been encouraging DHET that they must have more formal agreements with industry to ensure that these spaces are opened up. The challenge is that some of the industries prefer their own training. So your motor car industries, for example, they would rather have their own training centers rather than giving these students to your TVET. And we are saying, actually, if they do it with a TVET, they increase more their pool rather than privately funding their own colleges. It's a challenge that we are trying to break, to broker through ensuring that the adopt a college that is being advocated by the deputy president, encouraging the industry to adopt colleges. And we believe that the more they adopt them, and they'll be interested in those colleges that they have adopted, and they will learn more and start trusting what is being done in them. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Still on the TVET colleges, the other angle is there a budget in the Department of DHET to train the trainer to produce teachers for TVET colleges? Because you might find that the problem is quality training, and the industry then decides to shut down, to say they're not going to take, there's a high risk, if they cannot get people who have been, you know, trained qualitatively. But what you're also on skills development, what you have not touched is your CETA. I don't know if you have information in your monitoring. Also, you are monitoring performance by CETAs, because we have a skills gap, but we have CETAs who receive money from government, and this skills gap does not get closed. And I'm talking 26 CETAs, and we have information, though I think that information needs to be validated, is that in terms of the legislation, also the money that has been paid to CETAs cannot be, I need the right word, roll over, they get it, but cannot be retrieved, it's a saving, cannot be taken back by government because by National Treasury, because legislation does not allow that. Now you might find that they're sitting with exorbitant amounts, surplus, that we have no control over. But if you are to go by, this is taxpayers' money, and we need people to account on every cent of the taxpayers' money, there's something that is missing there. There's a missing link. So, as this committee, we're looking for money so that we can, for reallocation where the money is needed. Now, if there's money that is seated and we have no control over it, we have a problem with that. Now, in your planning and monitoring and evaluation, if you can also look at that, maybe you could also recommend introduction of legislation, so that the money that is paid to, I promise you, see, we're talking SOEs and abuse of budgets. You might find that the same applies, with the CETAs. No one is going in there to get a full account on the money that is allocated to CETAs. So there's money that you can tap from there. And also the value for money, from them. Why from time immemorial we've been talking skills gap, but they've been created with a purpose of closing that gap, but we still are sitting with the same problem. So I think if you can look at that as well, and also emphasize the introduction of legislation that will make them to account and bring back the money that they have not used. You don't want to wait until other parties in the house start shouting, bring back the money. Want that money for good use. Honorable Manana. Honorable Member Chabas.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the Chairperson has touched something very serious, and I hope you're going to give it the attention that it wants in a very radical fashion, because we really want to know how much is in that, in those details. I remember in last year, the chair actually asked the Department of Higher Education to come with the legislation, and I thought they would be bringing a legislation in that direction, but they haven't. So just speed it up. But I come from a place, it's a very small town called Hoedspruit, and it's only white people there. And they don't like politics so much. They're busy with their farms. But they come to my office for assistance when they've got problems with the farm. They happen to have problems with water. And when they came to me, I called the Department of Water Affairs, and it assisted very quickly. Then they said, Sheila, you must make a meeting with the president to go and ask him to put somebody in government who can communicate the good things that government is doing, because we only hear the negative. Because that problem was a serious problem, but it was solved within 3 days, and they couldn't believe that this is how government works. So I'm saying to you as the most reliable overseer of government, that you should put somebody in your department who can, on an ongoing basis, make the public aware of what you are doing. Because although we've got challenges, but I've heard a lot of good things in your input. And I'm a member of parliament, but I'm hearing them for the first time. So why are you hiding all these things? You must put somebody full-time to inform every one of us.
Yeah.
Whether it's challenging, look at the suggestion that Comrade Manana has given you, because you didn't think about it, the thing that we must have a change of thinking about TVET. And so it just shows, if we had known this thing maybe 2 years back, she would have given you this advice long ago. But we didn't know about it.
Much, Chairperson. Mine is just a small thing. It's with regards to the details. I'm not definitely sure whether the department have evaluated the work of the details. If they do have any reports, can they share with us so that we know exactly what is really happening there? Thank you.
I wanted to propose that department also looks at the SOEs, because we don't have much said about the SOEs here and the work they do in pursuit of the NDP goals and the implementation of the MTSF priorities. Perhaps in the next